on? Can everyone hear me? Is the mic on?
No.
Can anyone hear me? Yes.
Too loud.
Too loud? Still too loud? That's good. Okay. So as Steve said, I'm going to talk about entanglement and ensemblements. And I'm really using this as a case study in super selection rules and reference frames, and even going beyond that in quantum information. So this is work done. So well, as Steve said, I'm at Griffith University in Brisbane, Australia. He's there as well. He is also in Brisbane, Australia, at the University of Queensland, and this is joint work with him and also with an honours student I have with me at Griffith. Okay, so the motivation for talking on this topic. Well, I think we all, given that we're all here, presumably all believe that super selection rules and reference frames are worth considering in this context of quantum information. And personally, I think that entanglement is the most interesting aspect of quantum information, and that's why I'm talking on that. Okay, what about ensemblement? Well, as you'll come to understand what I mean by this as we go along. But basically, I just think of it as some sort of constraint in quantum information, which can perhaps be described by a super selection rule. So why concentrate on this one? Well, the most obvious way to formulate it in super selection rules is in form of a finite group. And so this is different from most super selection rules which people consider, which have been based on lead groups. So I think just that difference makes it interesting to look at, because it's a less familiar concept, less familiar mathematics, and the concepts are not so obvious. So I'll take a little while to talk about what a reference frame means, for example, in the context of a super selection rule with a finite group, and other things like that. Okay, but the main point is to be talking about entanglement constrained by this super selection rule. And you can use this to illustrate a lot of interesting things which Steve's going to be talking about further this afternoon, and that's analogies with concepts in mixed state entanglement. So I'll do that just to sort of prefigure Steve's talk a little bit. And you get links in with reference back again there. And then the beyond part of my title is that at the end of my talk, I'll talk about perhaps going beyond super selection rules in describing what we mean by ensembles as a constraint. Okay, so that's motivation. The outline of my talk I've made is a series of questions and with numbers, just so you have some idea where I'm going through the talk in the titles. So I'm going to begin by talking about what entanglement is, next what a super selection rule is, and then what is, then putting this together, entanglement constrained by a super selection rule. Then I'm going to specify by looking at this super selection rule for ensembleness, and then going back to this to say how much constrained entanglement is there then in ensemble quantum information process. Then I get onto the topic of a reference frame, which will actually be quite a long section because there are a lot of issues arising out of this. And as I said, I'm going to finish by talking about going beyond the super selection rule and revisiting this question of how much constrained entanglement there is in the ensemble quantum information process. Okay, so first, what is entanglement? So I'm going to, in this whole talk, concentrate on bipartite. But even given that, there are many different concepts of entanglement. So this is not a definition, this is just a characterization, if you like. This, I would guess, is probably the strongest characterization, to say that entanglement is a property of a system, in this case shared by two distant parties, such that their expected measurement correlations are inexplicable without faster-than-light signal. Okay. So one could slightly weaken this by just saying that, well, the two parties might not actually be distant, but at least potentially they could be distant. And if the same results were obtained, then it would then, you know, that means that there's the potential for faster flight system. So if entanglement of this sort is present, then I think it's fair to say that it's likely that it would be useful entanglement. That is, it can be used for quantum information tasks such as dense coding, teleportation, scheduling, and probably others. So that's why I sort of picked such a strong one, because it, I think people would be almost be certainly be willing to admit that this is useful. Okay, but why have, did I say useful? Useful. Why start, however, with such a strong but sort of operational characterization of entanglement rather than a mathematical one to do with separability of states or something like that? And the reason is to avoid what Keith Burnett has called fluffy bunny entanglement. And that is, if you define an entanglement mathematically, then you can find it anywhere in the world just by decomposing Hilbert space in a way that you want to. So doing it this way is really emphasizing that the way I see entanglement is it's something to do with systems that different parties can own and about the correlations, the special nature of the correlation between those systems. So some of you know, and Rob Spence told me that soon it will become very widely known indeed, that I used the term fluffy bunny entanglement in a talk that I gave last year at a conference in Palm Cove, Australia. The reason I reintroduced it here is mainly just so that I can reuse this cartoon that I prepared for that conference. So anyway, seriously, moving on then, that's all I want to say about fact at the moment, obviously we'll come back to it. But now I'm going to talk about what I mean by super selection. So I think it's worth emphasizing a couple of points which are different from perhaps the way super selection rules are generally regarded, is that the way we are defining it, and I guess this formalization owes most to the paper with worked with John Vaccaro and then Steve Bartlett last year, is to emphasize that we think of a super selection rule as a restriction which could be fundamental or practical on the allowed operations on a system, not on the allowed states of the system. Okay, so it's a restriction on operation. So operations, for anyone who doesn't know, includes unitaries. So if O is an operation, then that's a unitary operation. But it also includes things like measurements, where, for example, these would be the operations. You have to have a set of measurement operators which satisfy this. Okay. So more specifically, we define a super selection rule to be something associated with a group of local physical transformations, little g, represented by unitary operators, t. So then what is a super selection rule? It's the rule that the operations must be g-covariant. And by that we mean this down here. That's for all states and all elements of the group, it doesn't matter whether you do the transformation before the operation or the operation first and then the transformation. Okay, so that's what we mean by g-covariant operation. So this slide is not particularly relevant to the rest of my talk, but I just thought, since it may be of interest, I put it in, to talk about the relation between this concept of super selection rule and sort of more traditional concepts. So the first, as we've heard already, the super selection rules were more or less introduced by Wick, White, and Vigna in 1952, and they talked about, you know, super selection rule for charge, for example. So for a particular operator or observable, rather than the super selection rule associated with a group of transformations. And they also talked about the relation between that and the conservation law, so I thought I'd comment on that. My naive view, at least, is that the relation between a super selection rule like that and a conservation law is that you can derive the super selection rule from the conservation law for global charge, say, Q, if first the universe is assumed to commute with the global charge, and secondly, if the global charge is of this form, in other words, if it splits up into a sum of charges on local subsystems, Q sub K. So under these circumstances, you can derive a super selection rule for local charge Q sub K, which means Q sub K, which roughly means that it's forbidden to create superpositions of local charge. So the important point to note is that the super selection rule applies to a non-conserved quantity. In other words, local charge is not conserved, but nevertheless it obeys a super selection rule. It's not really any point talking about a super selection rule for something that's conserved. Okay. So how does this link in with the definition which we propose for super selection rule? So saying you have a super selection rule for charge or a charge super selection rule is the same thing as saying a super selection rule associated with a Lie group G generated by that operator, by that charge. Okay, so that's the relation. Okay, so why do we make it you know, life more difficult by talking about more general things is because we are interested in non-abelian cases, in particular non-abelian D groups like SE2, and what I'm going to concentrate on in this talk, which is finite groups such as the symmetric group. Okay, so what's the consequence then of this superselection rule, if you have a general superselection rule for some group, is that if that is the case, then no physical results from any measurement will be changed if you take your state and replace it by the transformed state. Right? Because because the order doesn't matter in the end, to work out measurement results if you were traced, and because the order doesn't matter, then this is going to have absolutely no effect on measurement results. Okay, so I think with quantum information, most people agree that the most natural way to interpret the quantum state is as a state of knowledge. So in that context, because these states are all equivalent, so this forms basically an equivalence class of states, the best way to represent the state is the one which has no irrelevant information. Okay? In other words, what we want to choose is the most mixed state in the equivalence class of states under our superselection, because that's the one with the least information, and so therefore it only has relevant information. And so the most mixed state is the one where we simply mix over all elements, all transformations in that group. So in the case of finite groups, that means this. So we define this curly G is a mixing super operator acting on rows, defined that way for finite groups and that way for Lie groups. So we can call this is the G invariant state in the same equivalence class as the physical state we started with. And we call that because it's very easy to verify that it is in fact invariant under any of those transformations now, because I've already mixed those all. Okay, so that's there. Okay, so again, just to point out very quickly that with traditional superselection, with a single generator, this mixing superoperator here just breaks up or destroys the coherences between subspaces of different charge. Okay, but under the more general groups, the operation of this is going to be much more complicated. Alright, so onto the topic now, putting together entanglement and superselection rules, we have the concept of entanglement constrained by superselection rules. And so this is, work that I did with John Picaro and also with Steve last year. And basically the definition we propose is this. But probably easiest if I just explain it first with a picture and then go back to the formal definition. So we start with some system, quantum system S, which is shared by Alice and Bob. Okay. But there's superselection rule in force which constrain the possible operations that Alice and Bob can do. So then the question is, so if there was no superselection rule, then the entanglement that they share is very easy. You just, you know, take a pass or a trace, one side work out its entropy, if it was a pure state that I was in here, work out its entropy, and that would be the amount of entanglement that they have. But because there are operations in force, that's the restrictions on the operations, that's not... it's not so easy. So the way we define it is to say that let Alice and Bob have some registers. Okay, so by register we mean something which is a conventional quantum register for which there are no superselection rules in force. Okay, so if you have states here, then there is no doubt about what the entanglement is. Okay, that is right. So then what we say, yes, so Alice and Bob each have registered, they are initially unentangled in pure states, and then Alice and Bob do the best that they can to transfer any entanglement which may be in the quantum system into their registers by using these local operations, which are assumed to be G covariant. Okay. And so that at the end of the process, Alice and Bob simply calculate how much entanglement they have between their registers, and that we define as the constrained entanglement in the original quantum system S. So just writing that out mathematically, so we just start with registers in a pure state, a quantum system in some arbitrary state. We do these operations to transfer the entanglement from one to the other. We maximize over all possible decovariant local operations of the entanglement that ends up in the registers at the end when we trace out over the system. Okay, so that's the concept, and the nice thing is that we can prove a theorem that the theorem says that the superselection rule can be enforced by removing all the irrelevant information from Drive, okay, as I was sort of muting in that earlier slide, by this decoherence or mixing process. That's to say that the answer to this maximization is that the G super selection rule constrained entanglement in the quantum system is just equal to the distillable entanglement in the G invariant form of that initial state. So there's a proof there, I'll just skip over that. I think if anyone's interested, we can come back and have a look at that. Okay. So now I'm going to talk about this ensembleness, which is going to occupy the rest of the talk, and what the super selection rule for that is. So what do I mean by ensembleness? Well, okay, so I mean in the sense, this ensemble in the same sense that is used in the phrase ensemble quantum information processing, okay, which is typically applied to NMR quantum information processing, for example. All right, so what it means is that we have N, which is typically much bigger than 1, for the Avogadro number even, identical copies of what I call a molecule consisting of a number of parts, and for simplicity, let's here say that it consists of N qubits. Okay. And so that's one important feature of it. And that second important feature is that all operations are symmetric. That's to say, all operations affect each molecule identically. So how does that apply in NMR, for example? Well, there, a molecule in inverted commas becomes a molecule without inverted commas, because that's really what we're dealing with there. And the qubits, typically, then are atoms. The qubit, in fact, is in the spin half nucleus of each atom. So, for example, I could have a case where N equals 4, and simplicity, just to say that all four nuclei are of different species. So I could, for example, have a hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, fluorine nucleus in each molecule. And then in NMR, the reason that the operations are symmetric is that they're done using radio frequency pulses, magnetic fields, an antenna, etc., which is uniform over the entire sample, typically. Now, as many of you will know, in NMR quantum information processing, there are a lot of other things that one could say about it, how it differs from conventional or ideal quantum information processing, in particular that the molecules are prepared in highly mixed states and the detection efficiency is very small. But I'm going to regard these as sort of inessential to the concept of ensembles. Okay, that these are other constraints which, you know, I'm not going to talk about because I think these are the ones that are more interesting from a sort of fundamental point of view. So then, how can we express this idea of ensembleness in terms of a super selection rule? The basic idea is this restriction on operations, that if they must treat all the molecules identically, is that you can swap two molecules and it will make no difference in your system. So you've got your little beaker of fluid, and you pick up a molecule from one place in and put it somewhere else, and put the other one back, it's going to make absolutely no difference. So we can write that by saying that the operations... Well, basically, what we want to look at, yes, we can swap the molecules before or after doing the operation. It makes no difference. So T here, it's a P stands for permutation of molecules. And this is just a unitary operator that implements that permutation system. So if you want to sort of think about it from a more formal view, we actually have, in a sense, N systems here. Which are all being acted on by this permutation in the same way. So for N equals 4, I have the, you know, N hydrogen atoms, could be like an Avogadro number of hydrogen atoms, an Avogadro number of oxygen atoms, Avogadro number of carbon atoms, and Avogadro number of fluorine atoms. Those are my four systems, but when I act on them with a permutation, they move together within a molecule. Okay? So obviously, I physically, in the system, I don't take a hydrogen atom from one molecule and put it onto another molecule, and vice versa, I move all of those in sync. Okay, so that's the way that the transformations act on my systems. Okay, so there are n factorial permutations that are very easy to see, and they form a group which is called the symmetric group S sub n. So then I can apply all the formulae which I've built up, using the symmetric group now, and for example, then the symmetric group invariant state is just this randomly commuted state down here. Alright, so just to give you a very simple example to see how it's going. Let's say that m equals 3, and we'll see how entanglement, yeah, how it's as well. And say, yeah, all right, come back up. Say m equals 3, and say that my nuclei, I'm going to call them a prime, and b. We'll see why in a second. And say, just to make things very simple, that there are only two molecules, so n equals 2, right? And let's say that the state happens to be prepared like this, okay? So this is not, this state does not, it is not a G-invariant state, but it's just a state, because otherwise we can't see the effect if we have a G-invariant state, but this is just to show what the permutation does. Alright, so the reason I call these A prime B is that I'm going to consider that the A and the A prime belong to alphas, okay, and the B belongs to Bob. So what does this mean to say that they belong to Alice and Bob? Well, in principle, you can imagine, I mean, this is not practical, but if you want to talk about entanglement in this context of ensemble quantum information processing, we really want to talk about different particles. Now, this is very difficult when your quantum computer, so to speak, is on a molecule, to talk about, you know, about those different parts of a molecule being spatially separated. But we have to, in principle, we can imagine some chemical process that could, you know, strip all of the A and A prime atoms off the system, move it to another beaker, and leave all the B atoms still in the original beaker without affecting their nuclear spins. Now, obviously, this is not practical, but if you want to even talk about entanglement, I think we have to admit that, in principle, this is possible. And so this is the idea about, you know, at least we have potentially distant systems, so that potentially we need fast light signaling to explain the correlations, etc., if we have them. Okay, so, but I'm going to more loosely just talk about, as I said, like the A's belong to, or the A and A prime belong to Alice, and the B belong to Bob. So then the idea is that if we imagine them having been separated like this, that the symmetric group superselection rule has to apply independently to Alice and Bob, because if Alice now has a bucket consisting of molecules, each of which has an A and an A prime on it, and Bob has a bucket of molecules which are just B atoms, okay, then now if Bob switches two of his molecules around, it's not going to be the same thing for Alice. Okay, so I have local superselection rules applying. Yeah?
What are you treating as Alice and Bob's quantum registers?
They haven't come into it yet.
So it seems to me that if you're going to start talking about some selection rules affecting operations from your quantum systems to the registers, you must first define what is a register.
Okay, well, in general, a register is just something totally independent.
The point I'm making, well, I'm trying to make a little bit about that to make it straight on, is when I first read your paper, you seem to be treating the registers as being a pickup coil for the NMR, which of course cannot distinguish between molecules. But that's not what you do in the base NMR. Your register is another atom on the same molecule.
Well,
there is no
The register is neither of those things. It's neither the pickup coil nor another atom of the same molecule. It's something entirely hypothetical that doesn't exist in NMR.
Right, so this is not really NMR at all. This is something really different than you're talking about
now. As I say, all I'm trying to do is to characterize ensembleness and the restriction that ensembleness makes. I'm going to talk at the end about more practical, going beyond the superselection rule, and about what you might be able to say, which is perhaps more relevant to NMR. But at this stage, I'm just trying to capture what ensembleness might mean, and NMR is just a convenient example to talk about because many people are a little bit, at least, familiar with the idea of NMR quantum computation. It's typically referred to as ensemble quantum information processing, whatever. But I'm not claiming that this says anything about NMR experiments. Is that fair enough?
Yes. Can we talk about experiments, like you can see examples where you have the entangled space and
but not in the concept that I'm talking about, where you have a register. So the ideal concept of entanglement, as I said, is you have independent registers which are not subject to any superselection rule, into which you can transfer your entanglement. And if you have constraints that say that all of your systems, you can only do symmetric operations on all of your systems, then that even if hypothetically the registers would exist, it would restrict the amount of entanglement you could possibly transfer into those registers. That's what I'm saying. So that if you imagine trying to use an NMR system in which this operates, in which this super selection rule is strictly enforced and you can only use metric operations, then the question is, can you transfer any entanglement into registers, even hypothetically, imagining any allow operation with respect to symmetry? And the answer will be, well, we'll see what the answer is, but the answer is it's not the amount of entanglement you would naively calculate as being a system.
We think of the state of the
No, 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 but it had nothing to do with the mathematical state of the system. That was the point I'm emphasizing. I'm using entanglement as a physical concept to do with what measurements you could actually do which would not be explained without faster light signal. That's why I started at the very beginning by saying that. Okay, then you have to imagine that at least in principle in our system, we could separate it into two parts with two parties, and that those two parties could do measurements, and that the results of those measurements could not be explained without invoking fast and light signal. And I don't think anyone could claim that that's the case in any NMR experiment.
I will show you the data.
Well, no, it did that the one prove any.
Well,
yeah.
If you take that narrow definition of entanglement,
that's
wrong,
but
then you
will
be going on your path on
this question. Yeah, sure. I am taking a narrow view of entanglement. I absolutely agree. That's why, up front, my first topic was what is entanglement? And I had a very narrow view of entanglement.
So the ambition is so extreme that you can have full state symmetries, have something which provably does not have a decomposition in terms of separable states, and you would still insist that it's not entanglement. In fact, you would insist that it's a singlet state, right? The example of a maximally entangled state, you're entangled by your definition.
Yes, I agree. Absolutely. You've got the point. Okay. So, going back to my definition, this is the example, just to show how the permutation works. This is my imaginary state that I've prepared. It's a pure state. I've got two molecules, and the first molecule all the spins are up, and the second molecule all the spins are down. Okay, then we imagine that we separate the molecules so that Alice has the A's and finds B's, and Bob has B's. Okay, and then we apply the local super selection rule. Well, okay, then we talk about, okay, what happens in Alice's bucket when she applies the permutation. So there are only two molecules, so in this case there's only one permutation, and that's to, well, I suppose there's the identity, so there are two permutations, but the only non-trivial permutation is to swap one and two, and so what that will do if that's applied to Alice's bucket is to take these first two atoms and swap them with these two atoms here. So what we end up with here now is a state where the atoms are down, down, and up, and then up, up, and down, instead of what we had originally. So the point is that these molecules are no longer, well, they might be physically together still. Well, really, for this to make any sense, what we have to imagine is that the molecules have been separated, but we still could have had, there is still correlations in a sense between these molecules, but it's a different from the original one because we've swapped them around. So now, under the action of the superoperator P, that actually define that. So this superoperator P, which commutes under all the, which averages over all the permutations, in this case, acting on Alice or Bob, or both, it actually makes no difference. The original state which I have here goes to an equal mixture then of this state and the commuted state. And I'm introducing a bit of notation here. When I write what looks like a pure state, but instead of just having a plus sign here, I have a plus sign inside this U or union symbol. That means that this is a convex combination of these two pure states. Okay? So this actually means it's a mixture of this state and that state. And that's just a very convenient notation to use to be able to write things down more quickly, so I'm going to be using that a lot. Okay, so actually what I have on this side is now a mixed state, effectively. Yes?
There's something I want to ask. Why do you mix up the two states, but you only can read A and you kind of not B?
Because we're imaginary, we're going to talk... the question was, why am I only swapping the state of the A and the A prime? Swapping the A and A prime atoms, but not swapping the B atom. And the reason is that if we want to talk about entanglement, as I said, we have to separate the systems into systems which belong to Alice and systems that belong to Bob. Okay? And once we've done that then, as long as we're still constrained by the symmetry, So you have to imagine that the molecules I originally had have actually been split. And for example, all the hydrogen carbon atoms have gone to Alice, and all the fluorine atoms or whatever have gone to Bob. And then if we're still constrained by doing symmetric operations, then that means that in Alice's bucket the molecules can still be, you know, shaken up and it makes no difference, so that I have to apply the permutations to that. Does that answer your question? Okay. Alright, so that's just a simple example to show how the permutation decoherence or mixing process works. More generally, if you want to work this out in general for a state, you have to go into some group theory.
How am I going to do it?
That's my 40-minute mark. Isn't it?
The window's not at 5 minutes.
I didn't start at 22.
10 minutes.
Okay. Okay. So I think we've had things like this flashed up before. So I'll just go through it briefly. The point is that under symmetric group, so the symmetric group in some sense is dual to the SU2 group. So it's actually the same structure that we want to consider. That my Hilbert space for n qubits, for example. So yeah, I'm just going back to a very simple case where I have one party and one qubit on each molecule. Then. So in that case, it splits up like this. So I have decoherence. Where are we? Okay, so I have different charge sectors, if you like, where here the charge is J, which is actually related to the angular momentum. And so joint operations, such as rotations of all the molecules, etc., actually act on this subspace here, and that, in this context, is going to be the decoherence-free subspace. Whereas the second one is where the permutations is, so the subsystem, if you like, described by this little space here, is the one on which the permutations act, and that's going to end up being the decoherence full subspace under this mixing operation. So yeah, so basically we have this basis for this alternate basis way of writing this basis for n qubits, which is in terms of j and m, the usual angular momentum numbers, and J and P denoting the permutations, and where P ranges from 1 to this number here, PJ. So as I said, the action of the mixing superoperator is to mix over all the states in this subsystem for each and destroy the coherence between the J. Okay, so now the action of, let's start now with the entangled state in order to answer the question, you know, how much entanglement is there in the system under my definition constrained by this super selection? And I actually found out recently that Steve and I were actually stupid in this calculation, that there was a paper in PRL in 2000 done by the NSICE and a number of co-workers, which essentially did the same calculation, but they didn't present it in the context of super selection. But anyway, okay, so I'll give them all the credit for that. So what they considered was an arbitrary pure state, well, an arbitrary entangled state for each molecule, and then they're all prepared identically so that the whole thing is a tensor product state for all the molecules. So Alice and Bob, in this case, each have one atom, okay, atom A and atom B. If I were to rewrite that state in the new basis vectors that I introduced, decomposing the Hilbert space in that convenient way before, it looks like that. So if you work out the entanglement of this state, well, it's much easier to see. In this case, it's just n times the entanglement within a single molecule. Okay, and so that's what you would, you know, from quantum tomography or whatever, if you said that was the same each molecule, that's what you would work out the entanglement for. But the point is, under this super selection or the symmetric group super selection rule, by imagine splitting the molecules and giving the A atoms to Alice and the B atoms to Bob, okay, and then mixing over the all permutations on both sides, then this state goes to this mixed state here. So again, it's a mixed state because I have these convex combinations here, like that. So I split up into the different J values, and then over each of these, I actually completely mix over all permutations. So how much entanglement do you get then to isolate it out of this? They worked it out. Comes out to be given by this expression here. So I think I won't say too much about that, but just point out that all the entanglement which is left is the entanglement which exists in this entangled state, which is only supported within the angular momentum, if you like, subsystems. Okay, so what we did, we did a much simpler calculation, but one for which it gives a little bit more insight, perhaps, because we took asymptotic limits. The simple case where we had Bell state, so that we start off with maximally entangled atoms in each molecule. Okay? So in that case, the entanglement which you would have naively calculate would be just n, that's n times 1 cubic, sorry, n times 1 eV per molecule, so a very large amount of entanglement. But if you calculate the entanglement under the super selection rule, it's given exactly by this expression here, but for large n, it's asymptotically given by half of the log of n. Okay, so the point is that you get much, much less entanglement out when you're constrained by the super selection rule than when you're not. And in fact, because this turns out to be the maximum amount of entanglement which you can have in your system under this super selection rule, what we can conclude is that the entanglement per molecule must go to zero as n goes to infinity under this super selection law. The constrained entanglement under this super selection law. But with this, comparing log n with n. Okay. Now, okay, since the topic of this conference includes reference frames, I want to talk about what a reference frame means for this system. But first, generally, what do I mean by reference frame? Well, I just say the reference frame for a super selection rule is something that ameliorates that super selection rule, something that takes it away its effect, at least to some extent. Now, the interesting thing is, so for typical super selection rules, you need a classical reference frame that's a perfect reference frame has to be in infinitely large quantum Hilbert space. But because the symmetric group is a finite group, you can actually get a perfect reference frame with a finite system, with a finite quantum system. And the simplest way to think about that is that it's just a reference frame is just a way to label the molecule so that you can tell whether or not they've been commuted. So for example, let's think of the case where n equals 3. I have 3 molecules, and I'm just, so it doesn't matter how many parties there are, I just have 3 molecules, and can I tell if they've been commuted if molecule 1 has a label on it that says this is molecule 1, molecule 2 has a label on it that says it's molecule 2, and molecule 3 has a label on it that says it's molecule 3. Okay? So this could be implemented by saying that each molecule has attached to it a 3-level quantum system, and I prepare the first molecule with that in state 1, the second molecule with that in state 2, and the third molecule with that in state 3. So this is a tensor product structure. I have my original quantum state for the 3 molecules, which here I've just written as being unentangled, but they could be an entangled state. And then I have my reference frame, which is this other system consisting of all these other atoms. So here's this picture of it. So it's a classical light reference frame. Here's what these are. These are qubits, 2-level qubits. I draw circles with 2 lines in it. So these could be an arbitrary state, but I've labeled each molecule like this. So now if molecule 1 and 2 get commuted, I can tell because, in principle, if I can read these off, I can tell, you know, if they're still attached to the molecule, I'll know which molecule has been swapped. And in principle, that means that it basically removes the problem of permutation random. Okay. So it's almost trivial when you look at it that way, what a reference frame means for the symmetric group. Now, some of you would have noticed there was another picture on that previous page, and that was to do with quantum reference frames. And so this is something interesting, I think, that although that's the easiest way to imagine creating a reference frame for this system, you can actually do better by using some features of quantum mechanics. And so why one might expect that one to do better? So going back to this example, I had 3 molecules, and so what I introduced on this side was a 3-level system, okay, in order to uniquely give these a label. So the total size of the Hilbert space of this reference frame which I've introduced is n to the n. Okay, if I have n molecules, I need each one has, say, n levels in order to give a unique label to each molecule. But the size of the symmetric group is n factorial. That's how many members it has. And in for large n, that's approximately n on e to the n. Okay, so the point is that this is smaller than that number. So that suggests that this classical-like reference frame which we've introduced is bigger than it needs. And the nice thing was that, again, in a completely different context, Paul and Kempe, just early this year, showed precisely that using quantum mechanics, you can make a reference frame which is no bigger than it needs to be. In other words, specifically, what they said, or what they showed, translating it into my language, is that if you have a reference frame for each system of dimension D, okay, and D is the floor of N times R, where R is any number greater than 1 over E, okay, so roughly just say that D is roughly N times E, okay, or N divided by E, rather, that number there, okay. Then that the total size of the reference frame is D to the N, therefore, right? What they showed was that in the limit that N goes to infinity, this reference frame will work perfectly. Okay, so in other words, in the asymptotic limit as n goes to infinity, you can use a reference frame which is the same size as the dimension of your group, which is a very nice result. So what that means is that you actually have, so for example, they actually give you an example for n equals 3. Unfortunately, in that case, okay, so it would work perfectly if the dimension of each one was 3, then you would have a three-dimensional reference frame. That would be this classical reference frame here. They showed that if each constituent is just a qubit, okay, then you haven't got enough levels here to use this classical style reference frame, but you can use one of their quantum reference frames. It doesn't work perfectly because we're far from the asymptotic limit, but nevertheless it does work much better than you could do without using quantum entanglement. So that was the point, that you actually have to define a quantum reference frame like this. Your reference frame here actually has to be in an entangled state. And then after permutation, you have to do some complicated measurement to determine which permutations happen. So I thought that was interesting and nice to show that even in this simple case, there are interesting things to say about the quantum mechanics of reference frames. Okay, in the context of entanglement, what you really want is a shared reference frame. And so the simplest way to imagine that is to go back to the classical example, which is what I'm going to stick with. And just say that, well, Alice and Bob, we start off with molecules which each have two labels on them, which uniquely define them, and then when they get split, Alice keeps one label and Bob keeps one label, and so that they're again able to keep track of what the correlations are between their molecules. So then this is what their reference frame writing out. So that's what it looked like before they split up or whatever. That's the writing out in a molecule by molecule basis, writing it out as system tensor reference frame, it looks like that. So this reference frame here, the point about it is that this is being a reference frame like this, obviously this is not a p covariant, this is not a p invariant state. Okay, because we've labeled each molecule and distinguished each molecule. So this is a state that cannot be created if you started from a p-invariant state and were only allowed to do p-covariant operations. So shared reference frame, if you have like this, basically negates the effect of the superselection rule. I could get all the entanglement out of the principle. So what I've got here is some sort of non-local resource. Okay? So we can lift the symmetric group restriction on entanglement, but it's something which is hard to get because in itself this reference frame cannot be created under my superselection rule if you start with a state which is invariant under that superselection rule. So what we have is this concept of under a superselection rule. Not only is entanglement constrained, but that things which are not entangled become in some sense non-local, because this is a new resource we have, a new non-local resource which allows us to do things that you couldn't do before, and that is to get the entangled out. So this is precisely analogous to the analysis that Frank Ostrava and Ignacio Serrat did for the U1 group last year. Okay. although I'm not sure if they use the term reference frame, but this idea about another sort of non-local resource that appears under restricted selection was introduced like that. And you might actually go a lot further, and Steve Bartlett's going to be talking about this afternoon, that you get, if you push this, you get analogies with mixed state entanglement theory. And so I'll probably have to rush through this. So don't worry if you don't catch what's going on here, but these are really to illustrate things that Steve is going to point out this afternoon, to just show that they arise under the symmetric group. So what I'm going to start with is just to show an example. I'll just skip to the picture. So it's all the stuff on the outside. What I'm doing is creating a particular state here, a two-molecule state, but it's an entangled state of a particular form, which has the property that its entanglement is zero under the symmetric group superselection. And if you want to, the actual definition of this state, it's defined here in terms of correlations between triplets and singlets, where these triplets and singlets on each side, so it's like, triplets correlated with singlets, and then plus singlets correlated with triples. Okay, so as I said, you can show that under the symmetric group superselection rule, there is no entanglement for that state. But obviously, if I had a reference frame for those molecules, then I would have entanglement here, and everything would be nice. So this is actually analogous, we would claim, to activation in mixed state entanglement of an NPPT state by a PPT state. But as I said, I won't talk about this because Steve's going to talk about this afternoon. Another analogy we can make with mixed state entanglement is the idea of a distinction between one distillable and two distillable states. So that although this state has no entanglement from say those superselection rule, if I have two copies of the state, I do have entanglement. So what does two copies of the state mean? It doesn't mean that I have this molecule 1, molecule 2, and then molecule 3, molecule 4. No, my symmetric group is fixed. Okay, I have precisely two. I must therefore always have precisely two molecules. So two copies of this state means that each molecule gets an extra atom. Okay, and that now I have this entangled state here, and then another, the same entangled state between these additional atoms which are attached to each molecule. So, as I said, the nice thing is that neither of these states individually have any entanglement, but if I put them all together and work out the entanglement, I find that I have one even. So what this is saying in this, one way of interpreting this is to say that these molecules on the outside act as a reference frame for these molecules on the inside. So this is another example of a quantum reference frame. It's not a perfect one, but nevertheless, it acts that way. Of course, because this state is identical to that state, you could equally well say that it's these atoms here which act as a reference frame for these atoms out there. Okay? So these are just different ways of looking at the same thing. Basically, that one copy is not stillable, but two copies are. Does give it. Alright. So I think I better keep moving. So this is now onto my last topic of going beyond perhaps this symmetric group superselection. So the idea here, as I said, I've argued that this symmetric group superselection rule captures the idea that all elements, such as all molecules in a sense, have to be subject to identical operations. But the question is this actually enough to characterize NMR quantum information processing? Is it enough to capture the constraints of it? So again, I'm not going to be talking about constraints coming from state preparation or inefficient measurement. I'm still talking about sort of essential type constraints on the way operations perform. Now, totally symmetric operations that I talked about, which act on everything identically, also characterize spin squeezing experiments. Okay, that's the experiments where you have an ensemble of atoms, they're essentially different from NMR type quantum information processing, because in these experiments you can also do collective operation on the elements. And what I mean, an example of that is you can do, for example, collective quantum non-demolition measurement of the atomic spin in a certain direction. And once you've done that, you actually create a state that is entangled between the different atoms in your ensemble. So the reason it's called spin squeezing is because this entangled atomic state is called a spin squeeze state. So I would suggest that NMR quantum information processing, the idea of it as an idealization of what we mean by ensemble quantum information processing, is more constrained than this spin squeezing type of stuff, because you can't create entanglement realistically. If you don't start with it, you can't create entanglement between molecules in your sample. Okay? I've considered states where that existed, but that was just, you know, because it was interesting to consider states like that. If you talk about what you could actually create, then I think most people would agree that you can't create states like that if you don't start with states like that. So in other words, there's a stronger constraint than simply that the operations are symmetric. And what I would say, one way of characterizing that is to say that the operations must be non-collective as well as being symmetric. So again, considering just say we have one atom for the molecule that we're doing on, basically what it means is all you could do if you have one atom for the molecule is to rotate all the atoms, okay? So which I can write like that. So it's rotating all the atoms identically, and then at the end to do a destructive measurement of all the atoms in some basis, say the sigma z basis. So how could we characterize then this stronger constraint? And I have to say here, you know, I don't know the answer to this, but I'm going to present progress towards an answer. So the first point I want to make is that I suspect that this, you can't characterize this by any superselection rule in the form of a group superselection rule as I defined earlier. And the second point is that at least some stronger constraint can be found, and it is not too strong a constraint. Okay? So this is giving a partial answer to this question. So to get at it, the points to make are firstly that obviously if the molecules are randomly commuted and locally again if we're splitting them up. Okay, in other words, if we operate on the state by this mixing superoperator, then the entanglement which we obtain after doing that can't be greater than what you get under the symmetric group superselection rule, because that was precisely how we calculated the amount of entanglement under the symmetric group superselection rule. So in other words, if I do this, then I'm making it automatically at least as strong as a symmetric group superselection rule. So if I imagine that I do this first, I'm making that the constraint at least as strong as that provided by the symmetric group superselection rule. But then the point is that the S constraint comes from knowing that the NMR operations I talked about before, where you rotated all the atoms identically and where you measured each one destructively, they can be performed after doing this permutation by separating the molecules and giving one molecule, each molecule to a different person, and allowing them to perform individual unitaries and measurements on them. Okay, the point is, so doing this then is permutation, random permutation, followed by separate operations on each molecule, is necessarily a stronger constraint than the symmetric group one from the first argument, but it's not too strong a constraint to describe the NMR quantum information processing by the second argument. So in other words, it is progress towards a strictly stronger constraint. All right, so what does it mean if we actually do this? So I'm just going to consider a simple case where all the molecules are prepared in the same state at the beginning in the state rho AB. So again, I'm interested in entanglement. We're going back to this question about how much entanglement, so I'm considering now two atoms A and B. So if we randomly commute them on Alice's side and on Bob's side, and then separate the molecules now, okay, then all we have to make is that there are now N Alice's and N Bob's, each having one atom. And any pair of Alice's, you know, a pair of one Alice and one Bob now, will share this state here. Okay? So basically what this means is that there's a 1 on N chance that the Alice that you've chosen and the Alice we're considering and the Bob we're considering actually have an atom in their hands that originally came from the same molecule. But there's an N minus 1 on N chance that they have an atom in their hands that came from different molecules to start with. And if they came from different molecules to start with, then the states of the atoms of each of them is just given by tracing over the other end, which some other Alice or Bob respectively called, Bob and Alice respectively called. So that's, in other words, this rogue prime AB is the effective state that each Alice and Bob pair have. So therefore, the total entanglement between all of the Alices and all of the Bobs, given that they have to do all their things individually, it's bounded above by n times with their n pairs, n times the amount of entanglement in each one. And I've actually slipped in an entanglement formation there, because that's the upper bound on entanglement, and because that's the only thing we can calculate using. Okay. So this e prime sub n is the thing which we're going to calculate as our new upper bound. Okay, so almost finished. Okay, so the results we've got. So we imagine that, so this is the work with Steve Jones, my honors student. Each molecule is prepared in this entangled state here. And then this is my state of O prime, which you've ready to work out. Now we don't have yet have an analytical expression for this, but we know the following. First, if we start with the Bell state, then the entanglement actually, well, it starts off with one, obviously, then for one molecule, drops to less than one for two molecules, and for greater than two molecules, it's identically zero. So you very quickly lose all entanglement under this restriction, like that. So you might think that this is, well, this is terrible because this is the best you could do, okay? So any more than two molecules, you're dead. Interestingly, that's not the case. If you want to maximize the amount of entanglement that's left over with any molecule, you want to start actually with a less entangled state for a single molecule. Okay, you actually want alpha of this coefficient here to be order 1 over n, and then what we've shown is that you can end up with this upper bound of the amount of entanglement. So for any n, you can get a finite number here, but it seems to be of order log n over n cubed, which is much smaller even than we've got under the symmetric root of superstition as the upper bound on the amount of entanglement. Okay, conclusion. So I really just wanted to use this talk to discuss an interesting issue, such as how constrained entanglement should be defined in general. What is the idea of a reference frame, and is the interesting things you can say about quantum versus classical reference frames. The thing that Steve's going to talk a lot more about, which is comparing constrained entanglement with unconstrained entanglement for mixed states, and what that has to do with reference frames. And then finally, whether it's necessary to go beyond superselection rules to capture interesting physics. Future work, just in the immediate term, is to try to get, at least asymptotically, to get results for this analytically. Secondly, to go beyond, so to speak, that's to keep doing what we were doing, but to think really hard about, you know, what you might actually be able to do, to really try to capture, you know, what the constraints are, and you know, if you want to do a Bell-type experiment, you know, is it possible under any circumstances when you have an ensemble like this? One thing, I don't know whether this will lead anywhere, but the idea of this at the end of having constraints not described by superselection rule, whether thinking about this simple example might lead to any insights to other constraints, such as LOCC, which are also not described by superselection rule. And then last, just to mention my collaborators in general in the area of this conference, John McCarrie, Steve Barlow, and Rob Speckens, and I'm sure that the work I've talked about has links with all the work which I'm doing with them as well, and look forward to pursuing that. Thank you.
The constraint and entanglement, if I understand correctly, is equal to the entanglement of the state after mixing it or the group. But the elements of the group are acting globally.
No, they're not. They're acting locally on each side.
So each element in this job. It's each T of G.
Yeah, okay, so I should, I haven't made that obvious enough, I haven't made it obvious enough in the mathematics, but, whoops, the, Yeah, these are, when I say these operators in G covariant, I mean they're locally G covariant operations. So this mixing G is actually